This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to Newfoundland and Labrador this week. I'm John Soper. In this episode, we'll hear the adventures of a nun from St. John's who spent more than three decades working in Uganda. Carolyn Ray brings us the story of a disabled man whose power has been cut off because he can't afford to pay the bills. Volunteers with the Purple Heart Campaign in Labrador make recommendations on how the legal system can better protect women who are victims of violence, and the saga of faulty cancer tests continues. A woman from Mount Pearl believes her life has been shortened by a mistake at Eastern Health. The former nurse says she didn't get the right treatment and fears she has also been misdiagnosed. Mark Quinn told her story to Jeff Gilhooly on the St. John's Morning Show.
Her name is Donna Howell, and she was a nurse for 28 years. She first worked at the Grace and then at the Health Sciences Center here in St. John's. She has two daughters, and she is part of the class action suit against Eastern Health over hormone receptor testing. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2003, and she immediately chose to have very aggressive treatment.
I had a double mastectomy. I had six rounds of chemo. I wanted to do everything I could to see if I could possibly prevent this from coming back. So, to my mind, if it had come in one breast, then there was maybe a higher risk that it would come in the other. I just didn't want to take the chance.
It's Donna Howell, and she says Eastern Health made a mistake. Tell me about that.
Well, after she was diagnosed, she had a hormone receptor test. It came back negative, and she was told she wasn't eligible for tamoxifen. That's a treatment that's been shown to greatly improve survival rates. So 2 years after she was diagnosed and treated, her cancer did come back, and then she had some more bad news. Her doctor told her that Eastern Health got the hormone receptor test wrong. A retest found that, in fact, she was positive, and she probably would have received tamoxifen if she got that result originally.
Yeah. What effect does she think that has had on her?
Well, she fears that she missed an opportunity to get treatment that would have lengthened her life. She wonders if her cancer would have come back at all if she was given the right treatment in the first place.
Maybe had I been on that tamoxifen from the beginning, would the cancer have ever gotten enough of a hold for it to have spread to my bones? So instead of looking at a life expectancy of, you know, close to the average person, now you're talking, you know, like probably 7 years, even if it doesn't spread from the bone. But then they told me that if it did spread from my bones to other areas, then I was looking at 1 to 4 years.
Donna Howell told me that she's trying to focus on enjoying what time she has left, but she did say that sometimes she wonders what her hormone receptor test might mean to her and her family.
You know, maybe it would have made a difference in whether I get to live to see grandchildren or whether I simply get to see my children educated. So my goal right now is to see the two of them educated, and anything beyond that's a bonus. No point in being angry about it. It's not going to accomplish anything. It'll only tear something out of me. And so at the moment, I concentrate on being positive and making the best out of every moment, and I'm going to try to beat the odds. Sorry.
Mark, what's her situation now?
She was told she has bone cancer and it spread throughout her body. She was also told that she has liver cancer. But after her experience with the hormone receptor test, she had doubts about her diagnosis, particularly about the diagnosis of liver cancer. She did a lot of research to find a clinic for a second opinion. She decided finally on a private clinic in British Columbia, and she paid for that herself. She had a PET scan done to look for cancer.
Yeah, what'd she find?
It confirmed that she does have bone cancer, but she said it found no evidence of liver cancer. So now she's left wondering if Eastern Health made a second mistake.
What's she saying about Eastern Health these days?
Well, she does say that she knows people who worked in the hospitals at the health authority. She worked with them for decades, of course, and she says that she knows they're careful and competent. But despite that, she said she explained that she is now part of the class action suit against Eastern Health.
Anyone can make a mistake, but the size of this mistake is not something that you could, you know, it's not excusable. It's not what I would have expected of the healthcare system. If someone had asked me when I was working there if this could ever have happened, I would have swore on a stack of Bibles it never could have. Because I honestly believe everyone was doing the best that they could. But this is not simply human error. There's more to it than that.
Mark, what's Eastern Health's response to this now?
I spoke with an official there yesterday, and she said that the health authority won't speak about an individual patient's case, and clearly that would be a breach of patient confidentiality. I also asked for an interview with Eastern Health's interim CEO, Louise Jones. I was told that the health authority isn't doing interviews about hormone receptor testing right now because it will deal with these issues through the Commission of Inquiry in January. Also, regarding that class action suit against Eastern Health, it was certified this summer. But the health authority hasn't filed a statement of defense yet. Eastern Health said that in cases like these, that's not unusual. So we may not hear from Eastern Health on this issue until January when the commission gets going again.
Not to the new year. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
Reporter Mark Quinn with Morning Show host Jeff Gilhooly. Premier Danny Williams says he's not pleased with the way Eastern Health handled its review of breast cancer tests. The health authority admitted at the end of October that it gave out the wrong information about the number of samples that had to be retested, and it missed 15 samples that weren't retested when they should have been. The Premier says the performance isn't good enough.
We're dealing with problems that go back to the mid-90s. So this is something in the system that we're trying to correct. You know, as you're aware, we've appointed the senior public servant, former clerk, Robert Thompson, to overhead a task force within to look at these problems. As well, we have Madam Justice Cameron's inquiry, which hopefully is going to get to the bottom of this. And in the meantime, as a result of our own initiatives within the department, we're now going back to Eastern Health and saying, look, what are your systems? What systems in place? We're doing the checks and balances to make sure that the numbers that we've been given are accurate. We're finding that some of these numbers are inaccurate. So as a government, we're doing everything we can now to make sure that we clean up any problems in the system from an administrative perspective and on a go-forward basis put the proper systems in place. So we're concerned as a government. And, you know, when any time I hear of a situation where there's been a mistake or something done wrong in the healthcare system, I look and I say, if that was me or my wife or my children, my grandchildren, relatives, brothers, sisters, that's the way we treat it, because that way you can really, from your own perspective, personalize and say, you know, this has a huge impact on these families. And that's the way we are treating it. And that comment actually comes up in every discussion that we have with the minister or with officials. Not happy with Eastern Health, I have to be quite honest with you. You know, responsibility falls back to the administrative group. And so, you know, if they need support, then we'll give them that support. If we need to bring in somebody to have a look at this, we need some expertise to come in that'll help them in their quest to make it better, then we will do that. But any time I hear numbers change, when we are given numbers as the public officials and we rely on those numbers and we give those to the public and then they change, then that legitimately causes concern. But all I can say is that we're doing absolutely everything we can now to correct it. But I wouldn't go so far to say is there's a crisis, not far from it. I mean, you can talk for every one person that has had a problem with the health system, there's thousands of people that have been served very, very well by the health system. So we don't want to create any panic out there. But that's not to say that there's problems as there are in any other department.
Premier Danny Williams. I'm John Soper, and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. A new report says female victims of violence in Labrador need more support from the justice system. For the past year, volunteers with the Purple Heart Campaign monitored how the justice system treated female victims. This week, they released a final report, including recommendations on how the courts can better serve victims. Reporter Kate Kaw was there and hears some of what she heard.
My name is Stephanie Flowers, and I was the project coordinator of the Purple Heart Campaign. I think in ways they're doing what they can with what they have, but there are certainly improvements that can be made in how women are treated, what access women have to services, and how the sentences are carried out. We spent a lot of time sitting in the court. Certainly I spent nearly every day, and we had several volunteers in the community who helped out sitting in that courtroom gathering that information. One of the biggest things that we saw were the delays in the courtroom. It was some cases were set 8 months down the road, and it seems to only be getting worse. Oftentimes, women were asked to come to court to testify for trial and showed up, and the trial was set over for a variety of reasons, whether the accused didn't have a lawyer or there just wasn't time to deal with it. And this forces women to prepare for that trial and possibly relive the situation over and over again.
Our first recommendation is the Department of Justice and the provincial court take steps to immediately address and reduce delays in court. One case that we followed began in April of 2005. There were a total of 11 appearances with a trial date set for 2005 and then set four more times. This case has not yet been concluded. Delays such as these can also open the door for the case being thrown out due to possible memory loss or as it is simply too old. Recommendation number two is that the Department of Justice and the Provincial Court begin renovations to the Happy Valley Goose Bay Courthouse.
I'm from Happy Valley Goose Bay, and I've been a victim of domestic abuse, and I was involved in the court system a couple of years ago. Well, it involved my ex-husband, who actually came into my house at about 2:30 in the morning. He was trying to put me out of the house. He had a key. He still had a key, so he let himself in. Came into my bedroom, turned on all the lights. Wouldn't let me sleep, wouldn't let me go back to bed. So I got up, tried to turn off the lights, but he wouldn't let me. So I went out into the hallway where he pushed me, and I slapped him in defense. And that's when he took me and he put me in a headlock and started to drag me down the stairs, breaking off banisters in our railings. My daughter woke up and saw it, and basically that's when the cops showed up, and he was arrested. I felt the Purple Heart campaign is really wonderful in terms of having the support there for the woman, to have someone monitoring the court system and what's going on and what the judges is actually saying when those cases come out. With regards to the renovations in the courthouse, the fact that it's such a small place and you go into the courthouse and the person who was in your house at 2:30 in the morning is now in the same room basically as you are, or if you want to go to the bathroom you've got to pass by them where they're staring at you, and this is just before you're going to court when you're already a little bit shaken because you've got to go testify.
And recommendation number seven, mandatory training for judges and Crown prosecutors about the nature of family violence. Ongoing training would help staff understand the complexities of domestic violence due to the relationship of the complainant and the accused.
Hi, I'm Leslie McLeod and President of the Provincial Advisory Council on the Status of Women. I think it's an incredibly important report that's come out of some very serious and critically needed work in terms of exploring and actually monitoring what's going on when women are accessing the justice system as survivors of violence. I think we have a system that's quite willing to attempt those improvements. So hopefully this is going to result in positive change. But the situation that was reflected in the report here is mirrored around the province to one extent or another. So it's a provincial issue, it's a women's issue, it's a justice issue.
Those are some of the women in Happy Valley Goose Bay speaking about the release of the Purple Heart Campaign report. It looked at how female victims of violence are treated by the court system. Wilson Rayfield Foster always believed that hydro companies didn't cut off power in the winter months, but now he's found out he's wrong. Foster woke up to find that his lights have been turned off until he can pay his outstanding bill of more than $2,000. But Foster is disabled, and he says his income is nowhere near enough to cover all his expenses. The CBC's Carolyn Ray went to visit Foster and his wife at their home in Kings Point, Green Bay. There, she discovered the Fosters don't think Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro is to blame.
Wilson Rayfield Foster lights a small propane burner. The 58-year-old man gets a cut from his wife and waits for a small pot of water to boil. Foster had a cold, sleepless night, and he's looking forward to some hot instant coffee. Last Wednesday, Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro turned off his power. Now this little burner is all he's got to cook his food.
We're going to be out of power for a long time. We've got to pay it off. $2,161.59 plus 50. That's the 50s for the hookup charge.
Just 5 years ago, Foster was living in Halifax, working as a long-haul truck driver and supporting his family. But all of that came crashing down when he developed blockages in his left leg. It had to be removed, and Foster decided it was time to come home to Kings Point to recover. A few months later, that same problem developed in his right leg. It, too, was amputated. Since then, he's been unable to work and living on a tight budget.
Can't mention disability, $8.30 or $8.50, somewhere, I don't know the exact dollar. And that's all the income we got.
Foster lives with his wife, Dorothy, in a small, run-down, two-bedroom house owned by their sons. A thin strip of pavement, just wide enough for a wheelchair, leads into the home. The roof is leaking, the paint is peeling off, the door frames are chipped and battered. It's a constant reminder of Foster's electric wheelchair. Dorothy says when her husband lost his legs, they only received $5,000 to make their home accessible. Now Foster sleeps in the den.
He had clean clothes in, but he got a hospital bed. The bedrooms are not big enough for his bed, so you can get the bed in there, but he can't get in with the wheelchair. And so I got it moved in here. He sleeps there and I sleep right there.
Dorothy Foster says she's in a catch-22. She'd like to work to support the pair, but she can't afford a car. And if she did find work nearby, they'd have to hire someone to be with her husband while she's gone.
Oh, my God. It's been 5 years leading up to this, you know, 5 years since he had his first leg up, and it's been going downhill ever since. I've managed to keep things going, but just can't keep going no longer.
The couple says their budget of over $800 can't handle all their bills, so Rayfield and Dorothy decided their electricity would have to be sacrificed. Last summer, they stopped paying it altogether.
The bottom line, yes, we was either the phone or the light, so we kept the phone. Well, like I said, if she falls down, I got somebody to call. I can't get out of here if she falls down. Or same thing for me, if something happens to me.
I got pork chops and fish.
The couple spends about $400 a month on food. Another $75 goes towards the phone and some on trips into Springdale. But there is one splurge. Foster is a smoker. He spends $200 a month on his cigarettes. Foster says he knows people are critical of his choice to smoke instead of paying his bills, but he says smoking is what keeps him sane.
Well, that's why I smoke. I don't drink. I haven't drank for 15 years. I give that up. And to sit here in this chair day after day after day, I'll go Jesus bananas.
This isn't the first time the Fosters have found themselves in a bad situation. A year ago, the town cut off their water connection because they hadn't paid their taxes in years. A group of people from Springdale generously stepped up and paid off the couple's debts. Kings Point's town council came under a lot of flack for the incident. But Mayor Baxter Newman says, like the power company, they had no choice. He says the couple hadn't made any attempts to approach the council for help, and something had to be done. In his office, Newman shakes his head when he hears that the Fosters are back to square one. He says it's a misjustice that the province hasn't intervened to help them.
They should be coming in and looking at him and saying, listen, we're here to help. You know, that is the purpose behind it, for those that can't help themselves, right? We're here to help. Why, you know, what can we do? And they should have, instead of putting gentlemen through this last winter and putting it through all this humiliation this summer, they should have been there in the beginning for him. That's all I can say about it, because it's sad that it happened this way.
But the question is, who is responsible for making sure people like the Fosters don't reach this point? Central Health says it can't do anything about the couple's financial problems. It says it's a provincial government responsibility. On Friday, the Fosters contacted the Department of Human Resources, Labor and Employment. HRLE says it will see if there's anything it can do to help. In the meantime, the couple has reached a turning point. After 37 years of marriage, Dorothy Foster is worried that the only way her husband will receive help is if she leaves.
I'm to the point now, if they don't take him and do something for him, he's just going to have to stay here because I'm out of here. You know, I can't do anything for him, and that's what it looks like. If he wasn't married, he would get help. We can't get any extra money because he's married to me. You know, what is wrong with the system? Because there's got to be something with the system.
The Fosters say what happens next is out of their hands. They're now waiting for answers and trying to stay warm. In Kings Point, I'm Carolyn Ray.
Sister Margaret Conroy is a remarkable woman. She's been a nun, a teacher, and an activist for more than half a century. And for the past 35 years, she's been living in the African country of Uganda. That's where she works to help make life better for people living in very tough circumstances. Sister Margaret was home in St. John's for a visit and to give a public talk. She spoke with Radio Noon's Heather Barrett.
Tell me about your first impressions of the country when you arrived there in 1971.
In Uganda, at the beginning, where I was, it was in the south, which is not too bad. I mean, the people are subsistence farmers. They grow their crops and they live off their crops. But because Uganda has a wonderful climate and two rainy seasons. People are not hungry. They don't die of hunger in the south. In the north, yes, where I am now, a very dry place where there are cows and there's not much that can be grown. One famine, one failure of the crop, and people are dying of starvation immediately in the north of the country.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about your present-day work, but I'm still really interested in your entire time in Uganda. You must have been there during the dictatorship of Idi Amin and all the horrible things that were going on at that time. What was it like?
Well, it was probably worse for those who were outside worrying about us than for us who were inside. I arrived with Amin the same year, and it was very quickly clear what kind of a man he was. I think he was a bit off his head, you know. But I remember on one occasion he came to our convent in Kalisizo to open a road, nice new tarmac road. And I said to my sisters, my goodness me, wouldn't this be a wonderful occasion to put a little poison in his soup? But we didn't do it.
No, I wouldn't think nuns would think of something like that.
Beg pardon?
I wouldn't think that nuns would think of something like that.
Well, it wasn't serious, you know. But he was really a very, very violent man.
Yes.
And, you know, all the Acholi soldiers that were in the army, when he took over, they were killed in a coup. They were just all massacred and thrown into the bush. So this is the sort of thing he was ready to do. And we knew, you know, what kind of a person he was after the first year. And everybody was waiting for the 8 years of his reign for someone else to come. And that happened in 79.
And during this time, what were the lives like for the people that you were working with and the children that you were teaching?
Well, the children were all right. It was more political, you know. It was political opponents, and it was in the army, the tribes that were not in favor of Amin that were being massacred. But the children in the schools were... You know, a school is like an oasis. It's protected. And it's if the administration of the school is doing their job, life goes on.
I want to talk a little bit now about your present-day life and work in Uganda. And you mentioned earlier that you live now in the north mm-hmm. of the country and things are quite different there. Can you tell me what that's like?
Well, the north of Uganda is an area where people cannot cultivate securely because they can't count on the rain. Therefore, they have cows. And the whole culture of the country is built on that, of that area. Karamoja, it's called. The Karamojong are cow herders, and they need cows to marry. And in order to get the cows, they have to raid other people that, you know, attack them and even kill them in order to take their cows so that they can then use those cows to get a wife or a second wife or a third wife. And... As a result, it's a very insecure area because if they can't get the cows by raiding another person with cows in another area, they will raid the road. They will shoot at cars because they all have guns, all of them. They'll shoot at cars, they kill, and they will take the money that they can get from whoever is in the car. So the only safe way to travel on the road is by bus. They don't shoot at the bus because they use the bus themselves. So that's the way we travel when we want to go south.
Now, I was sent an email that you have forwarded to many of the people that you stay in contact with here in St. John's about one of these bus trips. And
It's something, I'm telling you.
Can you describe for our listeners what that's like?
Yes, because I experience it often. We have to travel beginning at 4 in the morning, which means, you know, you don't get much sleep that night. And you get onto the bus early so that you get a seat. Because otherwise you'll stand in the aisle. And the bus is packed, three people in a space that's meant for two, you know. And under the seats there will be chickens. And in the aisle there will be sacks. And under the place where the luggage goes underneath, they often will tie up goats and put them down there. So the place is crowded. And the journey is very long. It's 12 hours to Kampala. And it is now 14 hours because they... are having to take a detour. You know, there was a big flood a month ago, and part of the road has been destroyed, which they have to bypass, which adds two more hours to the journey. So you begin at 4 in the morning. You arrive in Kampala, if you're lucky, about 9 o'clock at night.
Now, you're not a young woman. You've been a nun for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Why are you continuing to place yourself in such a dangerous and harrowing situation with these bus rides and living a life in a place where it's still quite violent?
If you feel a call to go to places like that, it's because you have a kind of sense of adventure. You know, I like risk. I like risk. I don't mind. And I think I'd rather be there than in a very quiet environment where nothing much was happening.
Now, tell me about some of the people that you're working with now in northern Uganda and in Kenya. You're still working with children.
Well, I'm doing a bit. I'm retired now, you know. I have no secrets about my age. I boast. I'm 77. And so I don't, and I'm very deaf. So I can't teach anymore. I taught for many, many years. But now I have a lovely apostolate in the prison once a week, which has 135 men and five women, only five women in the whole prison. And they are mostly there for having guns illegally and for shooting each other, killing, yeah, raiding the road, whatever they've been caught for doing. And they're in prison, and they wear these bright yellow shorts and tops, and so they won't run away. They'll be very conspicuous, you see. But the prison is, I like it very much.
What do you do there?
Well, what I do is scripture with them. We take a passage of, like, the prodigal son, you know, the story of the prodigal son, and we read it together, and we pray over it together. And then I get them to tell the story in their own words, their language, which I don't understand, but I have an interpreter. And then in the end, when they've done all that, we try to act it out locally, you know, using the local culture. And they did a marvelous job on The Prodigal Son. So we presented it about five times, and it was a great success. Did their morale a lot of good.
Now, you've also been doing some work with people living with AIDS.
My sisters do that. I assist them by being at home when they come back to talk about it. We have two of them are working in all the slums of Moroto with these people who are HIV positive. And they've gathered them into a group, and they try to help each other. They come and they kind of appoint a leader among them in each slum. And that leader will come to Paulina, who's my sister, and say, there's somebody else who's sick. Let's go and see her. So they go and see her, and they say, have you been tested? Don't be afraid to be tested. If you're positive, you will be helped. And they go and they get tested. If they're helped, they join the group. And when there's no food given by the hospital, then our sisters in Spain help us. They send money, and we give them extra food. It's a wonderful apostolate, you know, and our sisters love it.
But we hear so much now in the Western media about just the terrible toll that AIDS in Africa has taken on the people. It must be very difficult for the nuns that are working day to day with people like that. What are you hearing from the nuns when they come back and see you?
Well, it is hard. And that's why it's good for them to be able to talk about it. And I feel that's my role, to listen. I'm really interested in what they're doing. And they come to our house every week for a meeting. And the leaders, you know, of the different villages, and they share their problems, and they get a chapati, a big round piece of bread, and they have a cup of tea, and they pray together, and they go home really strengthened by that.
Well, it sounds like a remarkable life and work that you have, and it sounds like you love it.
I do. I really do love it. I hope I can keep it up for a few more years.
Thank you for coming in today and telling me about it.
You're welcome, Heather.
Sister Margie Conroy speaking with Heather Barrett of Radio Noon. That's it for this week's podcast. You can get in touch with us at cbc.ca by clicking Contact Us. Throughout the week, you can keep up with stories from around Newfoundland and Labrador at cbc.ca/NL. I'm John Soper. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.